Trent, I'm going to ask you to stay with us because we are going to continue our conversation on the climate. And we're going to take a step back now and look at one of the ways that global warming is going to be affecting the Midwest in the coming years. Last year, a nonprofit called the First Street Foundation put out a map showing the scope of what it calls the extreme heat belt. And the data behind that map predicts that by the year 2053, so in 3 decades, more than 1,000 counties across the U.S., including many here in Illinois, will experience temperatures, okay, you ready for this, above 125 degrees. There are people working on plans for climate-resilient housing that would protect us from heat like that and many other dangers of global warming. But different states and even different cities can have very different standards in their building codes. And some say that's an obstacle toward normalizing climate-resilient construction. All of this and more is covered in an article that came out earlier this month from the Midwest Newsroom, which is a collaboration between NPR and several public radio stations in nearby states. The article is called "The Future of the Midwest Includes Hazardous Heat, and Most of Our Homes Are Not Ready." Holly Edgel is the author of it and the managing editor of the Midwest Newsroom, and she joins us now. Holly, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Curtis Gobin is an architect with Architects Alliance in Jefferson City, Missouri. He's also active in the American Institute of Architects, past president of the Missouri chapter of the organization, actually, and he studies sustainable design. Curtis, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And again, Trent Ford, Illinois State climatologist, is with us throughout the program today. Thank you for staying with us. And listeners, we always appreciate your questions and comments. You can join the conversation at 800-222-9455. How is the place you live kept up with the changing climate? How have you felt the heat in your home? I remember seeing on Reddit during one of the heat waves this summer, some people in apartment buildings complaining that their air conditioning wasn't able to cool sufficiently with what was happening outside. So what have you done to make your home more climate resilient? 800-222-9455. All right, Trent, I mentioned that map from the First Street Foundation. What have you seen, again, as far as what might be ahead for Illinois in terms of this extreme heat?
Yeah, I mean, the message is the same. Every single time we see a study, individual study, an assessment like what we did a couple of years ago for the state of Illinois specifically, all the models point in the same direction as far as extreme heat's concerned. And, you know, we can measure extreme heat in lots of different ways. We can use kind of the highest of the high, what the First Street Foundation used, or I actually like looking at nighttime temperatures because that is an important period of time where people can cool off. And so an increase in nighttime temperatures is also concerning. And yeah, the direction that all of these projections are pointing is more frequent, more intense, and longer lasting heat waves all across the country. But, you know, we focused here on the Midwest in particular. And so, you know, this is something that you know, when we talked about, Brian, earlier about like, okay, you know, dust storms, individual kinds of extreme events, how well are they linked to climate change? And how are we seeing these trends? And some are a little bit clearer than others. Extreme heat is the clearest that we have experienced historically the last few decades, more frequent and intense heat waves. And we're very likely going to in coming decades as well.
Holly, you spoke with Iowa's state climatologist. What did he have to say as far as the effect that this more hazardous heat would have on people?
Right. Well, he pointed to just what Trent was talking about. One of the issues we're having is that the nighttime temperatures are not coming down. And it was actually one of his colleagues who works at the University of Iowa who talked to me about the susceptibility of different people to heat and the fact that it's a really big problem. It's not just discomfort, right? It's heat stroke. It's heat exhaustion. Some of these conditions can be fatal. And so we did see in Region 7, which the CDC considers to be Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas, a couple of days in August where collectively those states broke records on 2 days back-to-back for heat-related illness in ERs. And so this is a real issue. Like I said, it's not just discomfort. And the Iowa climatologist even spoke of his own home. He lives in a 100-year-old home, and it was not cooling down at night to the degree that he would feel comfortable with his newborn child, even with air conditioning going full blast.
Interesting. And like I mentioned, yeah, I saw a number of comments to that effect on different social media sites during one of the heat waves this summer. So, Curtis, one key to reckoning with all of this is what Holly's article calls sustainable housing that is climate resilient. Can you break down those ideas for us? What does that mean?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And one of those things with sustainability, when you're talking about buildings in general, let alone residences, is what does sustainability mean? What are you trying to achieve, and what's the big picture that you're trying to gain, or at least move towards or forward towards? And one of those things is from the architects and engineer standpoint, sustainability means how can you reduce your carbon emissions? How can you reduce your carbon footprint? Also taking in consideration, you want to use less materials to build your building. You want to be able to, the life cycle costing of all the equipment and everything that's put into your building is being efficient, meaning that the cost that you put into it is rewarding you over the life cycle of it being energy efficient. That way you get your monetary gains back. In addition to that, obviously your energy consumption for whether it's electricity, natural gas, or water, we're looking at ways of how you can reduce the amount of energy or water that is used in your building. So, you know, more energy faucets, fixtures, stuff like that. So that's kind of the big picture idea of what sustainability is and how we can maintain that and improve it moving forward incrementally so that we can continue to better ourselves.
Trent, maybe we can just take a step back before we start to get into some of the more of the details about sustainable housing and some of the challenges that come into play with that. But bigger picture, what are some of the obstacles when it comes to just dealing with global warming collectively as a society?
Well, I mean, it's a big problem, and it requires big solutions and many solutions, and both in the adaptation, which is just making ourselves less vulnerable, or the mitigation, which is actually fixing the problem, kind of what Curtis talked about with remove, you know, less, fewer carbon emissions. So, I mean, a lot of the problems come down to money and policy, to be honest. A lot of these solutions are there. It just requires a lot of political, economic, and will to put them in place, because we're talking about, you know, revamping how we're, for example, building buildings, designing cities, transportation, how we're eating, right? And these are not small parts of our lives. And so when we talk about frame all of that change, all of that necessary change into a period of time that is now, we're talking about a very small number of decades, that model suggests that we have to make meaningful change before the end of the century as far as the overall level of warming is concerned. It's a pretty monumental task.
You know, Trent, there's another angle to this, and that's that a lot of the effect we see from the changing climate are problems that are already being made worse by climate change, right? If there's going to be more heat waves, for example, housing insecurity, which is already a problem, becomes even worse of a problem because that's more people exposed to extreme heat. How does it add to the challenge if we're tackling that obstacle, say, in 20 years from now, as opposed to working on it now?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And this is actually a good news, bad news situation. The bad news is that climate change actually exacerbates a lot of already existing problems and inequities in our society. You talk about housing insecurity. Those who are in housing insecure situation are sort of at the front lines as vulnerability to extreme heat because they're the ones who have the highest exposure. That's the bad news. And the other bad news is when we follow those projections and say, if we're not going to fix this for another 20 years, we're going to even have even more exposure and vulnerability because heat waves are increasing, not decreasing. The good news part of that is that we've been needing to fix housing insecurity for a long time now, and climate change gives us yet another reason to do that, to put the resources in place to make those changes. So, you know, in some ways, when I talk about all of the solutions that climate change requires, some of those are solutions to problems that have already existed with or without climate change. And in those ways, you know, the all of the kind of momentum that's building around solving the issue of climate change, we have those solutions in place. Again, it's just a matter of making it happen.
We're going to have to take a break in a couple of minutes here, but before we do, Curtis, what can make building codes such an issue in making housing that's climate resilient? Let's talk about the sort of the government standards aspect of this problem.
One of the things that was mentioned You know, I'm a part of the American Institute of Architects, and it's an organization that's both nationally held and at state levels and then local levels. And so at the state level, AIA Missouri, which is the board of directors I sit on and was the president for last year, the state level focuses, and so does national, focuses on legislation. So what can we do at the Capitol? So we meet once a month, and we go meet with legislators and lobbyists up at the Capitol when they're in session as much as we possibly can. I think we met, we had 59 meetings with senators and House reps this past year. So to give you an example of scale of how often we meet with these people. But ultimately, it's navigating legislation from not only from the opposition, but also from, you know, trying to get out in front of it and be proactive. So there's many legislation efforts to where we don't agree with it, to where we think it's setting us back. And I'll give an example. And then there's legislation that moves forward. But ultimately, we need to come together to have rules and regulations that will help us and help govern us moving forward. And then we have kind of set in place at least a timeline to where we look at that again in what, let's say 3 years, for example. We look at those rules and regulations again and see how we can improve them. So that way we're constantly trying to improve our field while writing the legislation and kind of keeping everything in mind as we're moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And can you say in about 30 seconds one of the examples setting you back?
Well, so for instance, so we've been trying to get a statewide building code in Missouri for quite a long time. We're one of the states that doesn't have it. And I can dive into this later too. But for instance, before Mike Parsons became governor, we actually got him as a senator to sponsor a bill to help us, get third and fourth class counties to get involved to adopt a code. And ultimately, certain organizations or big sponsors of some entities got involved to oppose that legislation and knocked it down, meaning that they had political action committees with large reserves and a lot of lobbyists to help them, maneuver the legislative field. One of those other instances is...
I'm going to have to ask you to put a pin in that, and we'll come back to that. We are going to continue our conversation on climate change, and particularly as it relates to sustainable and resilient housing. Are we prepared for what is ahead? More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Please stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking about how global warming and our changing climate affect our housing, what's being done about it, and what is making it challenging to make those bigger picture changes in how we build our housing to be both climate resilient and sustainable. And we're talking about all of this with the Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford, an architect Curtis Gobin, and Holly Edgel, who's managing editor of Public Radio's Midwest Newsroom and the author of a recent article about all of this. You can join us on the air today at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. All right. I think we should turn in the time we have remaining to what sustainable, resilient housing actually looks like. And Holly, in the article I mentioned, you tell the story of Professor Hongxi Yin and a team of students from Washington University in St. Louis who entered a concrete house in a sustainable building competition. What went wrong for them, and what went right in terms of being climate resilient? What might we all see in, or should we see, in our housing of the future?
Sure. Well, and Curtis can correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of our current construction is what's called stick and frame, which is just what it sounds like in terms of building. And you can have various forms of insulation, and you can argue whether it's energy efficient, whether it's going to keep you cool enough in 30 years or not. But Professor Yin and his students from Washington University in St. Louis came up with the design using prefabricated concrete slabs, and they called it Crete House. And Professor Yin acknowledged to me that the point that Trent and Curtis have made, concrete does generate carbon dioxide poisoning in the atmosphere. So that in itself may raise some eyebrows. But what Professor Yin argues is that that is offset completely by the benefits of the energy efficiency and design of the house. So these students and Professor Yin went to Denver to this contest. They had a certain amount of days to build their house with a few other schools, and They did not finish in time. They failed to get in their heating and cooling system on time. But what they found was that even without an HVAC system, over the course of a week, the temperature in the Crete house remained steady and comfortable night and day. And he put this to he put this down to the fact of there's a thermal mass quotient that happens with concrete, where it traps the heat within the concrete and then releases it at night. So the inside temperature remains very comfortable even in the summer or spring. And if you think about that and adding an efficient system that will also help keep your home cool, adding ventilation systems. We don't really think about ventilation in the way that perhaps people living in tropical climates do when they build. We don't think about landscaping. Where do we put our trees? That was also part of the Crete house. How to funnel your tree, how to build and landscape so that your trees are funneling the breeze toward your house. How to build so that the trees are providing shade. All of these aspects were part of this design. And they were just really astonished to find that this house, with its concrete walls, its basic building blocks, was able to really keep people cool inside, and its energy efficiency down the road would offset any carbon dioxide pollution that's put into the environment. So this is just one example. Now, it was not cheap. It cost $500,000 to build, and it was less than 1,000 square feet. So that's not really, you know, an affordable option.
Like? Did it feel like living in a Yeti cooler or a bomb shelter or something?
He described it as feeling like, because I wasn't there, but he described it as feeling like a very pleasant sort of day in spring or fall where you don't need your HVAC on and your windows are open. That was the way he described it. And so I feel like we really have to get creative, and your guests have said this, in a very short space of time. We have to figure out what the materials are, what the the economies of scale need to be, how to get on the same page, and how to figure this out. Because as you know, in the Midwest, we have old brick homes. Here in St. Louis, it seems like almost everything is made of brick. And that traps heat. It's great to keep in heat, you know, keep you warm in the winter, but not great, you know, for hot temperatures. So, you know, and then you have the stick and frame situation, which may or may not be efficient and help you keep cool. So there's a lot that has to change in the way that we think about building in a short space of time.
Curtis, so let's talk about that cost. $500,000 for 1,000 square feet, if I remember the numbers that we just heard from Holly there. I mean, that's going to be, I can imagine, a lot of developers and builders sort of letting out a slow breath as they hear those figures. You know, on the other hand, people have been building houses, you know, out of some of those materials in Arizona and Florida. We have the expertise in the country. Talk about that, you know, how we reckon with those costs and that sort of change.
Well, cost is always a consideration, regardless of your project size or scale. Even for those who say that you have endless budgets, we have to be cost conscious. Also, especially when you're talking about affordable housing and how affordable housing thresholds can even be met, that all goes back to what are the costs of the building up front. So what are those material costs? How much did they overall project cost? That includes the contractor, the construction, anybody else that was involved in the design for homes. You don't necessarily need an architect for one and single, or for single and two family homes, but for anything that's larger than that, you get professionals involved. So that's why it's really critical whenever you're designing a home, and especially if you're designing a home on your own and you don't have professionals involved, there are nuances associated with these design processes that you may not be aware of as a home builder or as an individual who's just building your family home or dream home. And taking into consideration what those costs are, for instance, upfront, cost for a concrete house is obviously going to be more expensive than if you just did a 2x4 stick frame home. So, you know, and there's inherent R value in all materials. But for instance, that building that you just referenced, you know, you're talking over $1,000 a square feet for your house. That's kind of unheard of. And what the normal price for a normal home is, so, you know, somewhere between $150 to $250 a square foot for your house. Obviously, higher end homes with higher end finishes cost more, where you get a little bit more basic, lower end, as far as your actual finished quality materials, you can build a relatively cheaper home. But then it comes into play when you start talking about energy efficiency, how we're always moving forward, is what are those systems going to cost that are actually going to improve its performance? And then that we also look at its entire cost for the life cycle of that equipment. So when you say, I want ground source heat pumps, which is one of the most efficient ways to heat and cool your home, it's essentially natural air within your home that's forced pipes that are basically buried out in your yard somewhere that switch back and forth. And the natural bearing temperature of the earth, which is somewhere plus or minus around 55 degrees, that heat transfer from your air, it either pulls heat out of the air back into the earth, or it pulls heat out of the earth and back into the earth. So those energy efficient heating systems extremely high upfront costs.
Yeah. And Curtis, we had a little break up there, but I think we got the gist of what you're saying, which is high upfront costs. But Trent, as I'm listening to this, I'm reminded of a character in the Doctor Strange movies who is fond of saying the line, the bill comes due, right? So we can talk about these costs upfront when we're building this construction, but looking at this at a more societal level, if we're, you know, we're looking at the dealing, if we're dealing with global warming purely through an upfront cost lens, are we missing the forest, the burning forest for the trees?
Absolutely. I mean, Holly talked at the beginning about the excessive emergency room, emergency department visits just in that kind of Missouri, Nebraska, Iowa area, just from that few days. And there's been a few studies that have worked on this to try to put numbers to that. And it's in the billions of dollars for just a medium-sized city like Minneapolis, St. Paul per year in excessive heat-related mortality, morbidity, that comes from things like uninsured emergency room visits and things like that. The air pollution problems from fossil fuel use and carbon-based transportation, it kill hundreds of thousands of people each year or shorten their lives because, I mean, we're talking about, when we add all of those things up, it's a significant cost. And so you're totally right that, you know, we have to have the honest discussion that climate change solutions are not cheap, but they create a better world. And if we just want to talk about economic, it's sort of a short-sighted discussion, but if we just want to talk in economics, the long run savings is far outweighing the upfront cost.
Let's go to the phones. I think we can get Kay in Champaign on line 4 to join us. Kay, thank you for calling in.
Sure. I am wondering if perhaps we rely on AC too much. My air conditioner died in August, and while I was waiting, I was able to get open my windows, get a cross breeze, and I did it for at least a week. And then I've done it this month, and I did it last night, and it's still 71 in here. And I just wonder if, you know, of course you have to get up early to close the windows, but
and you have to have the breeze. When we had that power outage, we were out without power for 6 days over the summer, and there was no breeze at night. Let me tell you, we tried that. But yeah, I'm glad that worked for you. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. If there's a breeze, if there isn't, you'll get cool air immediately next to the window. But every little bit helps.
Yeah, every bit helps. Thanks so much for calling in, Kay. I appreciate that. I guess maybe that's a good segue into, I'm wondering, you know, we're talking about this at a, you know, in terms of the future and, you know, laws that might change. But what can people do now? And Curtis, maybe I'll say, you know, for people who are not building new homes out of concrete for $500,000, what are some smaller steps that people can take, you know, on the margins to improve their odds in future summers?
For new construction or existing homes?
I guess existing. Yeah, let's start with, we only have a few minutes left, so maybe we'll just, yeah, people who are not going to be building new houses.
Right. So there are a number of things, but ultimately, your frame to your home and stuff like that, you're obviously not going to be changing that. Those are wildly expensive to go in and tear out and do selective demo. But what you can do, for instance, people that have a home that has traditional vinyl siding, what they make now is they make what's called energy shield, which is also used as a kind of like a wood plywood board, but it's not. It's made out of foam with a foil face on it. And that could be a continuous layer of insulation that helps barrier, gives a barrier to your home to the UV and solar heat gain, which was referenced earlier, because certain materials will actually take in that solar heat, make it, you know, gain a momentum within that material. And then, for instance, like if it's brick, that heat will then transfer into that home later. But what my point is so for simple homes with vinyl, you can take off the vinyl on the outside. If you need to replace your siding anyway, you might as well go in and you can put in an inch and a half or a 3/4 inch layer of continuous insulation, and boom, you immediately just jump the R value of your exterior building envelope.
Interesting. All right. Well, we're probably going to have to leave the conversation there. I'm sure this is something we will be revisiting in future conversations as we continue to experience the effects of global warming. Curtis Gobin is an architect with the Architects Alliance in Jefferson City, Missouri, and he studies sustainable design. Trent Ford is the Illinois State climatologist, and Holly Edgell is managing editor with Midwest Newsroom, author of the recent article, "The Future of the Midwest Includes Hazardous Heat and Most of Our Homes Are Not Ready." Holly, Curtis, Trent, thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Brian. Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, it's our Friday News Roundtables. We're going to be focusing in our politics roundtable on the possibility, I don't know, maybe even a likelihood of a federal government shutdown. We'll talk with Linda Kenyon, who is Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent, about what is happening in the Congress, what is going on leading up to this shutdown. We'll also speak with Illinois State House reporter Mawa Iqbal, who's looked at what some of the specific consequences of the shutdown will be here in Illinois. That's coming up tomorrow on the 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Our intern is Nick Boyven. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. We do appreciate hearing from you on our shows, your suggestions for future guests and stories. You can get in touch with us by emailing talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org, and that is our web address, and there you can find every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line, and you can subscribe to our podcasts, or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen, The 21st Show. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.